Hey, it's Nishant, and welcome to Higher IQ. Hey, it is Thursday, July 23rd. Quick question for you. How do you feel about public transportation? If you live in the US and presumably you live in a suburb, you probably don't have to take it very often. And if you live in a city in the US, still, you probably don't have that great of public transport options. I take the Caltrain to work whenever I need to go in, and it does take 15 minutes longer than if I just drove, but I enjoy it. Whenever I mention that I take public transit, someone usually responds with some version of like, you know, dang, that must be annoying. I get what they mean, to be honest. The train runs on a schedule that's really not reliable, and the stations are not the most fun to be at. I mean, depending on the location, and sometimes the environment is a little sketchy, but, you know, that's just kind of what you get. And the worst part, too, is the frequency. I would say, like, at least for me, if I miss a train, depending on what time of the day it is, I could end up waiting another 30 minutes, probably even longer for the next one. But it honestly works for me. And I keep wondering why the experience here in America feels so much worse than in every other country that I've visited or even heard about. So I know Japan's trains run so precisely that the rail company issued a public apology in 2017 because a train departed 20 seconds early. That's not a joke. 20 seconds early, and they felt sorry. My good friend Todd was taking MARTA in Atlanta to a race, and he literally missed the race because the MARTA just stopped. So in America, if your train shows up within 10 minutes of the scheduled time, you consider that a win. Or I guess in Todd's case, if it just gets you to where you need to be on time, you're okay. So I've been to London a few times, and I used public transport the entire trip, including to and from the airport. You actually can land at Heathrow, hop on the tube, and then you're in the city for just a few pounds. In SF, I can actually do the same thing with BART that goes straight to SFO. And in Atlanta, I could kind of do it with MARTA. But the frustrating part is that always getting to the station in the first place is, like, difficult because there's just not much connecting you from where you live to where the train is. I personally solved that problem with a scooter, an electric scooter. It's super nice. It folds up, and I can just bring it on the train. But I know a lot of people don't have that option or choose not to buy a scooter. In European cities, that part is actually easy too. The bus and tram system or even the bike lanes get you to the trains pretty easily. And everything feels like it was just designed to work together rather than bolted on as an afterthought. So that gap is actually what got me looking into how we ended up here. And the story for why our public transport is so bad and why others are so good is actually a lot more deliberate than I expected. So in the early 1900s, more than 1,000 American cities and towns had streetcar systems. These are electric trolleys that ran through Los Angeles, Atlanta, Detroit, Baltimore, St. Louis, and dozens of smaller cities. They were the primary way that most urban Americans got around, and the infrastructure was quite extensive. Los Angeles alone had over 1,000 miles of streetcar track, which is more track than the city's current metro system has today. By the way, just going to say this out now, LA's public transit is pretty horrible. Anyway, continuing on. Between 1936 and 1950, a holding company called National City Lines that was funded by General Motors, Standard Oil of California, Firestone Tire, Phillips Petroleum, and Mack Trucks began buying up streetcar systems across the country. They acquired transit operations in roughly 45 cities, and in most of those cities, they converted the streetcar lines to bus routes served by GM-manufactured buses, running on Standard Oil fuel with Firestone tires. Who would have thought? The streetcar tracks were ripped out. The overhead wires came down, and in many cities, the bus service that replaced the streetcars was then allowed to decline in quality and frequency, which actually pushed more people towards buying cars. In 1947, the companies were indicted under the Sherman Antitrust Act on charges of conspiring to monopolize the sale of buses and supplies to the transit companies they acquired. They were convicted in 1949, and the fine was just $5,000. Think about that for a second. $5,000 for dismantling the transit infrastructure of dozens of American cities. To put that in perspective, a single GM bus at the time cost more than the fine. Historians debate how much blame to assign the conspiracy versus broader trends. Car ownership was rising everywhere in America during this period, including in cities where National City Lines never operated. Again, National City Lines was the company. The streetcar companies were already struggling financially because they were privately owned businesses that were locked into fixed rates that couldn't keep up with rising operating costs. Some researchers argue that National City Lines was exploiting a trend that was already underway rather than creating one. That's probably partly true, but the effect is the same regardless of the intent. Because by 1970, the vast majority of American cities that once had streetcar systems no longer did, and the country had committed almost entirely to highways and private automobiles as the primary mode of transportation. While America was tearing out streetcar tracks and building highways, the rest of the developed world was doing the opposite. Japan invested heavily in rail after World War II and built the Shinkansen, which is the first high-speed rail system in the world, which launched in 1964, connecting Tokyo and Osaka at speeds up to 130 miles an hour. Today, the system covers most of the country and runs with punctuality rate that borders on absurd. The average delays across all Shinkansen lines is measured in seconds, not minutes. Seconds. Japanese employers even reimburse their employees' commuting costs on public transit, which means taking the train is not just convenient, but actually financially incentivized, while car ownership in urban Japan is deliberately expensive through mandatory safety inspections, high fuel taxes, and parking costs that can exceed rent in some neighborhoods. Meanwhile, in America, I just remember the other day that there was some kid on the Caltrain who just got berated by the conductor because he didn't pay his fare. And the guy was like, "You're not allowed to ride public transportation unless you pay the fee." Which, look, I get it. We do need people to pay their fares in order to keep our infrastructure as crappy as it is. But man, like, it just feels like the differences are so cultural. Okay, let's move on to how Europe does it, because they actually took a very similar path to Japan. So France built the TGV, which stands for the Tron à Grande Vitesse, which translates to high-speed train, starting in the 1980s. And it connected Paris to major cities at speeds over 180 miles an hour. Germany has the Deutsche Bahn, which is a rail network that covers the entire country. China has built the largest high-speed rail network in the world. They did this from scratch in about 20 years, which is insane. They now have over 25,000 miles of track, carrying passengers at speeds up to 220 miles an hour. Meanwhile, the US Amtrak, which operates on tracks it mostly doesn't own, frequently runs behind schedule because freight trains get priority on shared tracks, and they cover the distance from New York to Chicago in about 19 hours. The same distance on a Chinese high-speed train would take roughly 5 hours. By the way, I know all about the Amtrak. My dad used to take it for over a decade, and I mean, there were so many times he was hours late because something happened on the train. I just feel like that's not happening as often in other countries. By the way, the average American household spends over $12,000 a year on car ownership. And collectively, Americans spend roughly $3.5 trillion annually on their 285 million registered vehicles. The infrastructure was built for cars. The culture was built around cars. And now the cost of maintaining that system is enormous, while the alternative barely exists. The reason that American public transit stays underfunded isn't just historical momentum from the streetcar era. It's actually a self-reinforcing cycle that's really hard to break. Federal transportation funding in the U.S. comes primarily from the gas tax. When the people drive more, gas tax revenue goes up, and that money flows almost entirely to highway construction and maintenance. When fewer people use public transportation, ridership numbers drop, which gives politicians less justification to fund transit improvements, which then makes the service worse, which then pushes people to drive, which generates more gas tax revenue for highways. The cycle feeds itself. Bad transit creates more drivers. More drivers fund more highways. More highways reduce the case for transit investment entirely. Even Australia, which has a similar geography and car-oriented culture, spends significantly more per capita on public transit than the US. Australia's most remote territories spend more on transit per person per year than any American state. The U.S. has a $140 billion backlog of deferred maintenance on its existing transit infrastructure, meaning the systems that we do have are falling apart because they can't get the funding to maintain what already exists, let alone build anything new. The housing episode that we did a few weeks ago connects directly to this. Single-family zoning and low-density suburban sprawl made transit economically unviable in most American cities because the population density isn't high enough to support frequent service. You need a certain number of people per square mile to make a train line or even a bus route financially sustainable. And American suburbs were designed at densities that make transit almost impossible to operate efficiently. The same zoning decisions that created the housing shortage also created the transit desert. And both trace back to a mid-20th century vision of American life built entirely around the automobile. Like I said in the beginning, I take the Caltrain most days and I love it, but I invested money to make that life work for me. I live about 5 miles from the station, so not exactly convenient, but instead of buying a car, I decided to buy an $1,100 electric scooter, which is actually so fun and easy to ride. But that solves the last mile issue, so now I don't have to worry about getting to and from the station. Most Americans choose that that's just too much of an investment or even a hassle to deal with. And I will say, like, I'm born and raised in Wisconsin, and you can't really ride a scooter year-round. So, like, having a car is just a very natural thing, and as it is in a lot of cities. And also, in those cities, the system is not designed to give them a viable alternative to driving. The country that once had a streetcar system in over 1,000 cities now has a transit infrastructure that ranks below most of the developed world. And the story of how we got here was very deliberate. To rebuild it in the other direction is going to take a lot longer and a lot more work than tearing it down did. The thing that I keep coming back to in this episode is how circular the problem is. Remember that bad transit pushes people into cars. Car-dependent infrastructure generates funding for more highways. And the case for investing in transit gets weaker every year, even though the need for it gets stronger. 1,000 American cities used to have a streetcar system, and a consortium of car and oil companies bought them up and ripped them out for a $5,000 fine. They killed the streetcar and then they buried the body. And now we live in a country where driving isn't really a choice. It's the only option. And the cost of maintaining the system is $3.5 trillion a year, spread across 285 million vehicles. I'm actually planning on taking the Caltrain to the airport tomorrow, and then again I'm planning on taking public transportation in Boston to get home. And I can guarantee you that there's going to be delays in at least one of those rides. If only I lived in Japan, where they'd apologize for being 20 seconds late. Stay informed, stay curious, use public transportation, and we'll see you tomorrow.